So I'm Josephine Ensign. I'm here today, Friday, October 28th, 2016, at the Jack Straw Studios in Seattle with Congressman Jim McDermott. Thank you so much again, Congressman, for being here. And as I was telling you before, this is for the Skid Road Project, which is looking, it's a narrative history project looking at the intersection of health and homelessness, poverty, especially in King County, but Washington State as well. So the first question I have for you is, what led you to the work that you do?
Well, I arrived in Seattle in 1966, July 1966. It was at the height of the opposition to the Vietnam War. This city was just absolutely on fire. We had bombings at the NROTC, and we had students taking over the freeway. And in the midst of all that, of course, was this infusion of drugs and free sex. I mean, the free sex and the drugs were all mixed together. And as a child psychiatrist, I was on duty in the emergency rooms, and I saw kids being brought in there. And we had no idea what was going on. And lots of times kids were in real trouble because they were not – they were uneasy about going to someplace like Children's or the University or Harborview because they were doing something illegal. So – I heard about this clinic, which was down in the area south of the main campus of the university. It's no longer there. I mean, there's huge buildings built there now. But it was a house down there that somebody had leased, and they needed volunteers to meet kids when they were in trouble. So that's how I got started.
And that was the Open Door Clinic?
That was the Open Door Clinic, yes.
And so what was it like working there? What do you remember about that?
Well, you have to sort of get the picture of kids doing everything in the world with chemicals to eat themselves, to other people, and there was every drug imaginable floating around. And so these kids would be brought into us by somebody who realized that the other kid was in trouble, but knowing nothing about who they were bringing in or didn't want to say what they knew or were afraid to be – they were willing to go far enough to bring them in, but they didn't want to be connected to them. So we had histories and record keeping and – we tried to, you know, be a honest-to-God clinic and act like professionals in dealing with these cases, but it was very, very difficult. So most of the time you were dealing with someone who had taken something that you didn't know what it was, and you were trying to bring them down from whatever kind of bad experience they were having. And we had, we saw all kinds of stuff. I don't remember us having anybody die. But we certainly had some kids that were in real trouble when they were brought in, some of which we shipped down to Harborview. And generally, we kind of triaged. We were a triage. We had nothing to treat people with. We were just professionals who were willing to be in a place that the kids felt safe enough to come to. And then we could see them and make a decision about what ought to happen
next. What happens? And when you say kids, were they mostly college age or like – teenagers?
12 to 25.
Okay, so
was a kind of a broad cut of the community. I don't know if we ever knew anybody's real age or real birthdays or anything. I mean, we had an awful time putting it together, but what we were – it was essentially battlefield. It was like the Vietnam experience that I later – saw people doing, where you're triaging people who are in terrible shape when they're brought to you, and you don't have any history to start with. And that's really where we were with these kids.
Right. So how long did you volunteer there?
When I was thinking about this before I came over here for this interview, I tried to remember. I must have been for the better part of a year and a half. I was here from July 1st, 66, and then I left for the military in July 1st, 1968. So I was here for a two-year period. So I was involved for most of that period of time.
All right. Okay. So, and what's like people that you met through that or other kinds of experiences that really influenced like your trajectory, what you ended up doing in terms of your work?
Well, I was a child psychiatrist. So I was seeing one part of the problem of child psychiatry, that is kids using drugs. I was also seeing homelessness, and I was seeing kids who were running away from home. In those days, a kid could be sent down to the juvenile detention center for being dependent, that is, not having committed a crime, but they could be sent there because they didn't want to go home, or they wouldn't say where their home was, or they wouldn't tell anybody where their home was. So that meant they had to be detained, and they went down to juvie, as it was called. So, I mean, that's been my life since that point. When I was in Congress, I had the committee that's job was to look at foster kids and homelessness, and I was the godfather for 500,000 foster kids in the country because I was running the program that under the Social Security Act, which is called Title 4E, I was responsible for that money and what happened with those kids. So it started in 66 and wound up in 2006 and 7 and 8 when I was dealing with in Congress.
Right, and extending the age.
Yeah, we raised the age. In those days, the state used to think that we were responsible for a kid in foster kid to be age 18, mm-hmm. or 21. And then we dropped the voting age from 21 down to 18. So the state said, well, if they're an adult at 18, then we don't responsible for them anymore.
That's what happened. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. We had the problem. Here was a war going and people were being drafted. And they were drafted and they were 18 years old, but they couldn't drink and they couldn't vote. And so we said, well, what is that kind of a deal? If you send somebody to war and they can't drink and they can't vote on the war, that's not fair. So the country decided to reduce the age. But in doing so, we took away 3 years of protection for young people.
I had not made that connection, but that completely makes sense. Right?
Yeah. Well, and we've struggled since then to get the – because when you're 18 – you might still be in March or April of your senior year in high school. You come home in your foster home and you find all your belongings in a plastic bag on the front porch and you're out because the parents aren't being paid for it anymore. So you're on your own, sweetheart. See what you can do. And we said, no, that doesn't make sense. Let's get it up to 21 again so we can at least allow states to have programs to take kids at least through school. And they were cut off Medicaid immediately when their foster care ended. So there were a lot of things that I was able to do as a congressman that I had seen a long time before.
Right here in the U District.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So what are some of the highlights for you, like when you think back of all that you've done in terms of especially advocating for health care? Like, is there one particular story?
There were, in my legislative history, I did lots of things over the course of years. I'm now archiving all my records at the University of Washington Archives. And I've been involved from my first year in the legislature. We had subsidized adoption. I passed the first subsidized adoption bill in the country. That is for kids who had either a physical or emotional or multiracial problems of one sort or another. They were hard to adopt. So the state would have responsibility for them, but people would like to adopt them. But they said, gee, if I take that kid, there's going to be some extra cost. So we decided let's have a program where the state will pay for the extra costs above those of normal child rearing. I mean, if you ever take a kid, you know there's going to be costs, but the extra cost is what the state picked up. So I did that in 1971, and in 2006 or 2007, I guess, I'm not sure the exact date, we passed the Foster and Connections Act, which expanded all the kids that could be covered and ways in which they could be involved, because we would take a child from a home and put them in a foster care and pay for it. We wouldn't take them from the home and put them in a family member's home, because that's kinship care. So one of the changes we made was we made kinship care reimbursable. And we did things for Native American tribes, and we did all kinds of things in that bill. So it was probably the highlight of my involvement with this whole issue. It was a great learning experience. Specifics are hard for me to remember back. That's 50 years ago. so I'm not up to exactly what, you know, who and what and where.
Right,
I remember some of the people. I can't even remember the names of people. Lee Kirshner ran the clinic. She's the one who kind of got it started. And there were a couple of guys from the psychiatry unit at the university that I got involved with. But the specifics of that early period are really blurred to me.
Okay.
I can't even remember where the clinic was. It seems to me it was like on about 41st or 42nd or something down.
Right.
But the university owned the house, I think, but they were just holding it till they were going to develop for something else, and they weren't doing anything. Well, it was a rundown little place, and there we were with anywhere from 5 to 15 or 20 crazy kids who were just out of their mind with pharmaceuticals of one sort or another.
Right. And I know, like, with some of the early free clinics that were starting up around the country, and Seattle's was one of the one of the earliest with Open Door. One of the other things that it seemed like a lot of them had in common was trying to reduce the hierarchy of medicine, of healthcare. Did you see some of that at play at all? I guess what you're saying in terms of triaging.
We took any warm body that was willing to help. And I don't know – I never saw anybody's certificate to prove they were anything. So I think people just showed up down there and, you know, nurses. And this was in the legislature in 75 or 77, somewhere in there. I passed a bill which set up physician's assistants.
Mm-hmm.
This place had the first physician's assistant. This is in North Carolina. Had the two first physician's assistants programs in the country. Then 2 years later, we did nurse practitioners, expanding the practice of nurse practitioners. And so people were doing all that stuff out there, but they certainly weren't licensed to do it. And everyone was trying to be careful not to get into legal trouble. But ultimately, it led to my understanding that the whole thing can't be in the hands of doctors, can't all be controlled by doctors. There aren't enough of us, and besides which, a lot of them don't want to do that kind of stuff. And there are other people who do and are perfectly – I'd seen these guys coming back from Vietnam by that afterward when I got to the legislature, and I'd seen guys coming back from Vietnam who were very skilled in dealing with trauma. But when I'd ask them, are you going to go, you know, do something with this? And when you get back, and no, I didn't even get a GED. It'd take me forever to get through anything. So that's when I began to realize that we should take these
medics
and turn them into PAs.
Right.
And then it was the next step. Of course, nurses were right there saying, "Hey, what about us?"
Right.
And
right.
And you know, so the whole of the evolution of the delivery of healthcare was started right there when we had this huge influx of people coming back from Vietnam.
Right.
And that made everybody start to think, well, wait a minute. The first bill I did in the legislature was a bill brought to me by a woman at the University of Washington who said to me, do you realize that only a dentist can put his fingers in your mouth? And I've got people trained that could clean your teeth, but they can't. They can only hand the instruments to the dentist who will then put the instrument in your mouth. She said, why can't somebody be trained to do dental cleaning? It's not, you know, this is not rocket science. Right. And she said, you know, you could teach people to do that. So the first bill I passed was a bill to expand or allow dental assistants to begin. The chairman of the committee at that point was a dentist from Bellingham by the name of Cass Farr. And he was absolutely opposed to anybody being able to put their fingers in anybody's mouth. Well, we ran over him and passed it in 1971. So, I mean, this was an evolutionary period in the expansion of healthcare delivery. And the so-called free clinics, I mean, they were sort of what got started. I mean, now you look at Country Doctor, and it's an old established place up on Capitol Hill. That started from the same movement.
It went
country and Pike Place Market, the Pike Place Doctor, that whole clinic.
And 45th Street, too.
Yeah, and the 45th Street was the same way. I mean, all through my district. My district covered most of these people.
And also the Black Panther clinics like Carolyn Downs.
Yeah, that started. That was a little outside my district. But, yes, that was also and then a little while later you had CMAR.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these things started in that period.
So tell me a little bit about your own motivation from moving from like direct physician care, child psychiatry, to working in politics. What was that going on for you?
Well, for me, it was very simple. I mean, not, in one sense, it's simple. In another sense, it's not. In 1966, 68, the period we're talking about, I was going through in my own mind whether I was going to go into the military or not. I was thinking about leaving the country. And I have in my files the letters that I got back from the Norwegian Medical Association offering me a job in Norway, north of the Arctic Circle. There's a city called Tromsø, which is above the Arctic Circle, and they offered me a job. There's a mental hospital there, and I could have left the country and become a exile there, as many were doing in Sweden and other places. And so I went into the military. I finally decided I was going to go in. And it wasn't because I couldn't learn Norwegian. And I mean, I could Google. I could figure that out. But I thought, it's my country and I've never done anything to try and change it. So I'm going to go into the military and spend my 2 years. And at the end of those 2 years, I'm going to try and stop this war and change what's going on. So I came out of the military. I got through the 2 years. It was not fun, but I did it. And I came back to Seattle, and within a month, I said to people, I want to run for Congress. And they said, you don't know anybody. You never lived here. You only voted here once in your life. What are you doing jumping into Congress? Why don't you try, start the legislature. Why don't you join the legislature? So I lived in the 43rd district, then away I went for the state legislature, not knowing that a Democrat had never in the history of the state won the 43rd district. I mean, so my first campaign I ran as Dr. Jim McDermott, wearing a white shirt and a tie, so everybody would know that I knew how to wear a white shirt and a tie and be a sensible candidate. And I took lots of twists and turns in my campaign, but my staying in politics and my coming back to it after I left it, because for a long time I was balancing medicine and the state legislature, And I was working 80-hour weeks, and my blood pressure was out of sight. And so I just decided I can't do two things. I got to do only one or the other. And I went back to medicine, the State Department. The reason I came back from what I had done in Africa, I loved my job with the State Department. But I was I knew the power of the ability to change things if you're in the political process. I had written the basic health plan. Everybody talks about the Washington Basic Health Plan. I wrote it, and I didn't get to be governor in 1984, but I got Booth Gardner to sign the bill, and then we signed the bill at Country Doctor after he became governor, and we started the Washington Basic Health Plan in 84. And a year or so later, I left the legislature. And so now I was out in Africa, and I thought, well, my brother said, come on back. We're gonna have a national health plan. Why don't you get involved in Congress? And so I came back because if I see a patient and I help you, you say, thank you, doctor. And I see another patient, thank you, doctor, thank you. In Congress, I can help 300 million people. So the difference between helping one who's going to say thank you and helping 300 million who are never going to even know I exist was much more appealing to me. I was more interested in what you could do to change what was going on in the society.
Right. So really looking at the politics and policy changes.
Yeah. It was all policy for me.
Right.
I wasn't interested in, you know, I like being a doctor. I was gonna do academic medicine. I thought if you'd asked me where I was gonna be 50 years ago, I would say, I'm gonna be probably a department chairman, or maybe a dean of a medical school or something like that. I mean, that's what my goal or the highest my sights were at that point for anything I could do. So I was looking at academic medicine then.
So it was really, it sounds like it was the Vietnam War.
Radicalized me.
Right.
When I came out here from Chicago, I was a straight, tie-wearing, no beard, no sandals. By the time I left those 2 years in Seattle, I was wearing sandals and had a beard, which I had to shave when I went in the Navy.
Right.
So I went, you know, I went for 2 years with a beard, then boom, it was gone and I was in the military.
So tell me about more of like your early life. Were there people in your family that that influenced you in terms of what you've done?
Well, I was raised in a fundamentalist home, a very conservative Protestant fundamentalist, the Independent Fundamental Churches of America, which is a little sect in the Middle West. And my parents were very generous out of what they had for missionaries all over the world. So they gave money, $10 a month, to people everywhere, all over the place. And as the war came on and the missionaries started coming back from China and from Japan and places like that, they would come and stay in our home. I mean, they would come back to the churches that had
supported
given
them
money,
right.
Supported them. And so I got to know a lot of missionaries. And one man, his name is John Linton, he came and showed slides about the Japanese planes strafing, the Chinese running down the roads. And I thought, I want to be a medical missionary to China. And I decided that and told my parents at age 8. So I made a decision at that point, which, I mean, medicine was interesting to me, both from that standpoint, but also from the standpoint of my family. My mother had asthma, and I'd seen doctors make my mother better. So I thought, well, that's a good thing to be able to do, is to make your mother better. So I had this kind of dual driving of the missionary stuff and my parents liked the idea of my being a missionary.
Were there physicians or nurses in your family at all?
No.
So that was a first?
No, I was the first one who went to college.
Okay.
So I went along, and of course, as I progressed, our relationship with China changed dramatically in 49 when it closed, and mm-hmm. so we didn't have anything further to do. So I never became a medical missionary. to China. But I progressed up my ladder. And when I was second year in medical school, I went to I had a program called Operation Crossroads, which was a work and study program in Asia or in Africa. There was a BRAC minister by the name of James Robinson from the Church of the Master in New York who said he could see that Africa was becoming independent after the Second World War, but nobody knew anything about Africa. So he started sending groups of students out all over Africa. And I went in 1961, I went and spent 10 weeks in Ghana, 6 weeks in a village, living, eating native food, fighting mosquitoes, boiling our water, using a latrine, the whole nine yards. And we built a two-room schoolhouse out of mud bricks. And then traveled around in Nigeria and Dahomey and now Benin and Togo. And that was where the hook got sunk for me in the third world and in the impoverished people of the world and what needed to be done.
So that was still when you were in med school?
I was a sophomore in medical school. Right. And the next year I came back and I was going to spend the summer in Nepal on a Smith, Klein, and French fellowship. The drug company in those days gave students summer internships. Well, it turned out they evaluated me. They said, we're not going to give you one because you've already been out of the country. We're going to give it to somebody who hasn't. Because in those days, nobody went out of the country. I now tell students in the university or anywhere else, if you want to be prepared for this next century, learn a language, learn to speak it, and go somewhere and live for 5 or 6 weeks away from a five-star hotel. Live as the people live, because it'll teach you the way 90% of the world is living, including our own homeless in this country.
Right. Yeah. It can really impart cultural humility.
And empathy.
Yes.
So it was, for me, that was the next big formative thing was that trip to Africa. And the rest is history.
Right.
Because from there, I mean, I was in medical school, finished medical school, then I went in the military, and then I got involved in politics. And I spent all this time in the state doing all kinds of stuff. And then when I left the state legislature, the period that I spent away from the legislature in July of 87 to April of 88, I spent in the State Department.
Mm-hmm. That was when you were in Africa.
Yeah, in Kinshasa. In the midst, that was the epicenter of the AIDS epidemic.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Right?
Everybody was there from the CDC, Jonathan Mann, and all the big names that people know now from the beginning were in Kinshasa because that was where it was happening.
So what were you doing there?
A regional medical officer for the State Department, and I had responsibility for the mental health of all the official Americans south of the equator, from Gabon to Somalia to the Republic. So I had 26 embassies that I was in and out of. It was a fascinating job. When my brother came out to get me to come home to politics, I said, nah, I'm going to do it. I got a good job here, and I got two kids in college, and I'm just going to get another race and lose, and I'm not interested in doing that. So, but here I am.
So it was your brother that?
Yeah, it was my brother and my campaign manager.
Right.
They came out. We got one you can win.
Right. So, so that experience that you had, especially at the AIDS epicenter in Africa, and when you got back into politics, what did that influence some of what you worked on?
I immediately started the AIDS Caucus, the International AIDS Caucus. I told the speaker, Tom Foley from his state, that there's a huge epidemic coming. And at that point, it was mostly among gay men. And the attitude in this country was sort of, what do we care? And they're gay men, and if they'd stop doing whatever they're doing, they wouldn't have a problem. Not realizing that it was across the board, men and women all over the world, and that was going to ultimately get to us. And so the speaker gave me a free ticket to go around and look. I traveled to Africa and Asia and South America and Central America and the Middle East, looking at what was happening in the epidemic and bringing back information to him so that he knew what was going on. I mean, what people don't understand about travel for the Congress is we think we run the world. Mm. Well, if you think you run the world, then you ought to go out there and have a look at the world and see what's actually going on, because you could sit back here and make your mind up about what ought to happen. But if you've never been there and looked at it and seen the reality of it, it winds up making a mess. So Tom gave me lots of freedom to do that. And the result of that was that this, about 2 weeks ago, I went back to India, where they gave me a Lifetime Achievement Award from the AIDS Foundation of India.
Congratulations.
For what I had done beginning in 1990. Because the first time I went out there, the Indian government told me they had 5 cases. Mm. We know one is, he's an African diplomat, he's already dead and gone home. And all of them came from outside. There's no AIDS in India. Well, I was smart enough and had done enough epidemiology to realize that this wasn't true. But one of the people who was there took me down to the red light district of Mumbai. About a 10-block-long period of Falkland Road, which has got 180,000 prostitutes in it who are doing 8 to 10 tricks a night. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, they were having 1 million contacts every night, with the infectivity rate from woman to man to be 30% or whatever it was. And I could simply multiply out on a piece of paper that they had 500,000 cases. And I said that to one of the reporters from Newsweek, and they put it in a magazine. And the next time I came, the Indian said to me, "How did you know how many cases there were in India?" And I said, "Well, all you got to do is
the math.
The math is very simple." And they didn't want to look at it for simple reason that they were opening up their economy, and they wanted people to come and invest in India, and they didn't want their reputation to be one that they got this huge epidemic of AIDS. Mm-hmm. So they were worried about what it would do to their image in the world rather than worrying about what it would do to
the population.
To ignore the population,
right,
and the problem. So, and of course, at that point, it was a death sentence. So I was involved in AIDS in the Congress, working on the whole business of PEPFAR, and, you know, and the one good thing I can say about George Bush is he started PEPFAR. I think he was really, he deserves great credit for that. Saved millions of lives across the world. You're asking me how did I weave a Persian rug?
Right. So were you involved at all with the Ryan White
legislation? Ryan White, forgotten the man's name in the Congress who had been involved in that, but that was started just a little bit before I got there, and I of course was involved in it afterward and continuing and getting it repassed. So I did the Ryan White Act, but I also did one of my own, which was HAPWA, which is the Housing for People Living with AIDS, the Bailey Boucher kind of thing. That funding never existed before 1989 when I got a bill through the Congress with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, the three of us. San Francisco, New York, and Seattle had the biggest AIDS problems. We went to the chairman, Henry Gonzalez, and said, look,
need the housing, supported housing.
So the housing program was another part of things I did in Congress.
Good. So what what are some of the biggest barriers that you've had? It sounds strange asking within politics, but what would you say kind of the biggest frustrations that you've had?
Well, I think for anybody who's public policy oriented or public spirited and looking ahead, you can see things that are going to happen or need to be dealt with now, and it'd be better to deal with them now than to wait until they become a big problem. It's like, that's why we do teeth cleaning.
Mm-hmm.
We do teeth cleaning to prevent cavities where you're pulling teeth out. I mean, everybody used to get false teeth when my parents, all their teeth were pulled by the time they were 45 years old. Well, we don't do that anymore because we've done fluoride and we've done all this prevention. So trying to sell prevention or trying to sell that we should do something about a particular situation before it becomes bad is always, I call it being ahead of the curve. If you're ahead of the curve, you've always got problems because nobody sees it yet. And you and to, in a democracy, before you can make something happen, you got to have a huge number of people see it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So they agree with you. Well, we got to do something about this. We're going to see in this country, I mean, we're having in this election the question of should we put a tax on carbon? And we'll see. This is the first state in the union where we're trying to do what they've been doing in British Columbia for the last 4 or 5 years. Well, we don't deal with global warming. The water is going to be up 4 or 5 feet and places are going to be underwater and
infectious disease spread.
Yes. And global warming is bringing vectors further and further north.
Yes.
Because people forget that the bad air of Philadelphia was mosquitoes and malaria. And we've wiped it out in this country and pushed it out. Well, but it's coming back. And now we got Zika and we got all this stuff. And so one of the frustrations is always, as a physician, you can see it. And I can tell you that if you don't do something about X, you're going to have a big problem in 5 years or 10 years. And you say to me, well, it's not much of a problem now, so, you know. Well, so you have to – I have to let you suffer through till it's really bothering you. Then you come to me, and I don't have to say I told you so. You know that. So at that point, we can do something. And that's where we are. I mean, this fight now we're in about national health insurance. I started that in 72. I made my first speech on single-payer health care because I saw what they were doing in Canada in the 60s. And Tommy Douglas was up there in Saskatchewan doing all this stuff. And I was in medical school at that time. And I was listening to the head of the American Medical Association tell us that socialized medicine was in Canada and it was a terrible thing and they were going to wipe out our profession and blah, 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 blah. But when I got to the state legislature, I wanted to do in this state what had been done in the 60s. So I came in the 70s and I tried and I got the basic health plan, but I couldn't get it universal in the state the way they could up there because we had federal laws like ERISA and other laws that prevented it. So I you know, there's always those frustrations if you're either too early or too late. And when you're on time, why things just go bing.
Right.
And
so what do you think in terms of kind of the future of ACA and changes that are going to be needed with that? What do you think we're headed
for? Well,
I
made a speech about 2 years ago in Chicago and said, single payer is coming. Winston Churchill said, that you can always count on the Americans to do the right thing, but only after they've tried everything else. And right now we're trying everything else. I mean, we made a deal with the pharmaceutical companies, which is a bad deal, and we made a deal with the insurance companies, which is a bad deal. And now they're raising the rates in the insurance companies, and they're still fighting the public option. Now, when it was put in 2009, Maria Cantwell and I and some others pushed to get a public option. Because I knew the Washington Basic Health Plan existed in this state because there was no private insurance company to cover people. Oh, low-income people, insurance companies don't want them. They want people that can pay good premiums. Well, so I knew that public option was going to have to be in this program, but we couldn't get it in. And we got the language in there that could be set up, and people have dragged their feet and dragged their feet and dragged their feet. Now with the insurance premiums going up from the insurance companies, you're going to have somebody say, you know, maybe we should have a public option.
Right.
So the timing, I was off. I was too far ahead of the curve in 2009. If I were going back now, I'd have a public option bill on the table on 2017, and we'd see how far it went. And so my view is that democracy is an evolutionary process that moves slowly and doesn't always go in a straight line. It weaves around and you think, oh, my God, we're – but then it gets – rights itself and brings it back up. And so when I look at it, it's really the ACA is in transition, and it will be. I mean, it is impossible for you and I, smart as we are, to sit down and write a public policy that's perfect, because we can't think of every option and everything that human beings will think of. So what we do is we put our best effort on paper. And I used to think, I remember when I started the legislature, I thought you write a law, it's done.
You go on to the next thing.
Right? You're back the next year fixing what you didn't understand last year. And this year you put down the best, and next year you're going to be back fixing what you didn't understand.
Right. Or unintended consequences of
unintended
that.
Consequences or
know.
Changes. I mean, AIDS or Zika or Ebola or people not getting vaccinations. My God.
And who would have thought that, right?
Who would have ever thought we'd have whooping cough in the Seattle school system?
Yes.
Or measles or mumps or all those things, that scarlet fever. And so one has to understand that there's always change. The question is, how are you going to react to it? Those people who want to oppose change, they're wasting their time because it's coming. It's just an inexorable force that's coming in all these places. And the more people you have in Seattle, I mean, I walk in here today and I look at those where they're putting in bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
And we're putting back railroad tracks. I mean, 40 years ago, we had a wonderful transit system in this city. They ripped it all up so that we could have cars.
And now we're trying to put it back.
Putting it all back at $1 million a mile or $2 million or $10 million a mile.
And over many, many years.
Everybody's saying, why? See, when I my first bill or the first hearing I had in the district in 89 was up here at the Walker Ames Room at the university, in which we talked about with Brock Adams and I were there. We said, we got to put together a transit system for Snohomish, King, and Pierce County. And it's got to be one system, not three systems. We're not going to bring back money and give some to Everett, some to Seattle, and some to Tacoma. It's got to be – so you guys in the legislature, you go down there and you write – and you put together Sound Transit, which is what they did. So that started in 89. Well, it was 2013 before we got to the airport with the system.
Mm-hmm.
And now this year we're to the university. And, I mean, that thing is jammed.
Yes, it is.
Everybody from the South End leaves their car at home, gets on the metro, and comes up through, and they're at the U, bingo. And they jump off over here and walk up on campus, and at night they go down and get back on and go home.
Right.
I mean, we could have had that in 1967 when it was first proposed by Warren Magnuson. But people weren't ready for it.
Yes. And it affects people getting to health care as well.
Of course.
It's
sure.
Huge. Yeah.
And the epidemic of asthma from all the pollutants in the air and all what's going on. I mean, there's all kinds of things which we inflict on ourselves because we didn't do what made sense from a planning standpoint.
Right.
So
thinking ahead.
Just say, well, it's too bad. A lot of people died. I'm sorry, but we're trying to make it better.
Right. So what do you want to work on next?
I thought this was about the community clinic.
It is. It is.
Well, you know, For 46 years, I've been at the beck and call of constituents. 600, 700,000 people in, or in a state legislative district, 100,000, or as a physician, you're the beck and call of your patients. I'm now retired from all of that, and I can choose exactly what I want to do. So I first piece of advice one of my colleagues gave me who retired before was say no to everybody. Because everybody says, well, you're retired now. You can come do this.
You could do this interview.
Yeah, you could do that. Well, that's why I'm here. Right. I got time.
Okay.
And so I'm in the process of trying to decide. I'm not going to retire and do nothing because that would be death. That's what happens to type A people who just don't do anything. The question is, what do you do? I'm talking with the university about perhaps teaching a bit here.
Nice.
And I've got a book. I was talking to a book editor to look at some stuff that I've written and tell me if, you know, am I going in the right direction or does it make sense? And there's some things on my bucket list I haven't done. I've been in 101 countries, but I've never been to Portugal. And I've only been in Barcelona and Spain and only in Paris and France. And so there's big hunks of the world that interesting places, lots of interesting stuff going on. So, and I paint. So I've got a whole, I won't have any trouble.
Right. So lots of things that now you'll have
more
time
on. Interest me
on.
And if I'm careful, I'll have more time.
Right. Well, we'd love to have you teaching here. And I look forward to your book as well.
Well, I being a member of Congress who's had the experience makes me a hot object.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been asked in Australia and in South Africa and in Germany and Ireland and a couple of other places to come for a quarter and mm-hmm. teach. It's fun to have lots of options. I mean, I have good friends in South Africa from my African experience, and one of the people said, you know, there's a fellowship down here at the university anytime you want to come and get it. And Australia, I've got the same kind of sort of – so I'm not worried about figuring out what I'm going to do with my time.
That's just deciding which one of those you want to
yeah.
do.
And you know, what's visible. And of course, as you get older, you haven't got quite the energy you had when you were 25 or 30 or 40 or 50. So, I have to tailor what I'm doing to what I'm – I don't want to be worn out.
Right.
So I'm looking forward. I'm excited about the future.
Good. And speaking of the future, what are your hopes for the future in terms of like King County, Washington State, the country, especially around kind of safety net healthcare services?
Well, I have been lucky and pleased to represent one of the most progressive parts of the country. This state passing levies for housing and all the Washington Basic Health Plan and the community clinics and all this stuff that's here, not present in other parts mm-hmm. of the country. And my hopes for us are that we will continue to lead the way. I mean, there are lots of places, lots of things that yet need to be done. And we should be right out there in front. And that's not only in healthcare. I mean, dental health mm-hmm. is badly neglected. And we have lots of people who don't have preventive care. And you want to get – I mean, not everybody's in the basic health plan yet or in the ACA. So we have to find a way to get everybody realizing that they can have health care and they should use it. Now, I have had cataracts and I hadn't paid attention. I was having trouble driving and seeing and stuff. And I finally went in and saw somebody, and the The ophthalmologist said to me, "Jim, you're a terrible user of healthcare. You should have been here 2 years ago getting these things fixed." Well, I was busy and, you know, and I could still kind of make out what was going on. And so I didn't go get it done. Lots of people don't get it done because they're afraid of the cost. And so, you know, there's all kinds. Their blood pressure's high. I mean, you take the chronic illnesses like blood pressure and diabetes and obesity and heart disease, all these things. There's so much you can do to improve the quality of life by prevention. And I hope that we will become known as a place that really works to prevent.
Well, and also, as you pointed out with asthma, the environment where people live, what they're exposed to, is a huge part of prevention as well.
I had asthma as a child, and seasonal stuff related to pollens from plants. And, you know, I was afraid that when I got this age, I wouldn't be able to breathe because I'd seen people with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And I thought, wow, I don't want that. And all these things that have been handled by application of medications in one sort or another can be prevented if people just know about it and felt that they could access it. I used to have a practice down at 1001 Broadway, and I knew the pharmacist downstairs, and I went down there when I had some hearing problems. And they prescribed some medication for my ears. And I went in, and the guy knew me, and he said, "Hey, Jim, sit down." I said, "Why? It's going to take long to fill my prescription." He said, "No, I just want you to sit down when you hear how much it's going to cost." And he, you know, gave me this extravagant figure, and I thought, my hearing, I'm gonna pay for it. But he said, lots of people can't fill the prescription. And that shouldn't happen in democracy.
Right.
Never. Everybody should get what they need. And if you need to have Cyclovir, which was what that particular I had a viral infection in my ear, and you know, and they said, "We don't know if it'll make it better, but it's worth trying." So I tried it, and I got 60% of my hearing, so now I got hearing aids, right? And mm-hmm. How many people do you know who need a hearing aid who don't have one? Because how do you pay for it? They're not cheap.
Or they get swindled by some of the companies, right, too, that prey on people.
And Medicare, when it was designed, didn't have pharmaceuticals built into it. Mm-hmm. So we had to build that in 2000 and whatever it was.
The whole donut.
And now we're going to have to build in hearing aids because as people live longer and longer in the racket that we live in, I mean, I worked on ships where there was high-pitched noise, and I know I damaged my ears in that. Now there was no such thing as OSHA saying that you should put on headphones to cover up your ears when you're—
And that was in the Navy?
No, this was I worked in the Merchant Marine.
Oh, okay.
So all of that, I mean, my hope is that we will as a society recognize quality of life is what we really want. It's not money so much as quality of life. How do we make that possible for people? And that is partly medicine, but it's also other kinds of things, art, music, and cultural experiences that will give people a sense of well-being that we sort of treat that as it's some kind of add-on or, you know, it's not really important. Well, it is important.
That's a huge part of health and well-being. Uh-huh.
And that's why they take seniors from the nursing homes down to see the opera on a afternoon
or art museums
or whatever, because you need stimulation to keep your mind alive. And now mm-hmm. we got this epidemic of dementia and Alzheimer's disease, and you look at that and you say to yourself, you know, how much can we prevent if we got people, kept them involved? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's probably some other answer. There's it's more than just that, but at least that retards the retards the process. Mm-hmm. So there'll be plenty to do after I'm gone.
Yes. So are there any things that you wished I'd asked about that you wanted to add to this at all?
That's a good interviewing technique used by all good reporters. No, I think I've wandered on far enough.
Oh, well, again, I want to really thank you.
You're welcome.
For taking time. The beginning of your retirement, right?
This is a start.
You haven't officially retired.
Mm. No, I'm not retired until the 4th of January.
January, right.
Yeah.
Okay. So I wish you well. Thank you.
You're welcome.